welcome to the Enlightened Medicine Show with Dr. Valerie Olmsted, the holographic physician. And before we get started, let me just mention that our sponsor is Hydramay Skin Nutrition. If you haven't tried it, please do. It is amazing, all-natural stuff, and you can throw out those $400 skin creams and just do something that's all-natural and is wonderful for your skin. And our special guest tonight that you guys are probably well aware of and waiting for, we have David Sarita again. Hi, David.
Hi, Dr. Valerie. Good to be on your show again.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to have you. And you've got some really exciting stuff to talk about tonight. And I did watch your video, Mona Lisa's Little Secret. Thank you so much for that. And I'm just so excited about this whole thing. So let's launch into what the video is about. And I know you have some history to talk about, the history of the Catholic Church and how they tried to wipe out all the contact that had anything to do with women and all that kind of stuff. It's a huge subject, I know.
The historical background, before we get into what is Mona Lisa's, you know, deep secret, I just want to start by saying that, you know, for myself, it was a surprise because I had read Michael Bajan's, you know, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, you know, back in the, I think it was the 70s or 80s when it came out. And, you know, I read all the Gnostic literature. I had studied the background material that became very popular with Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, and I actually think Dan Brown, I mean, he made this stuff really popular, which is great, but he made a lot of mistakes. Mm-hmm. But he's the guy who popularized Da Vinci Codeism, even though the real researchers who did the hardcore work were way in the background, and they were quite popular too, you know, in the 1980s, Michael Bajan and the three authors who did The Holy Blood and The Holy Grail. So there I am, you know, in 30 years of meditation, I think I described in our last show when Christ appeared to me in a blaze of light, 1,000 times brighter than the sun in 1994, when I was freezing to death in my tent living in Topanga, California. And upon that visitation, I had the power instantly given to me to see the dead, to see the invisible spirit beings with my eyes open as clearly as people see each other. I don't intuit them in my mind. I don't get mental pictures. I actually see them, you know, in the same 3D space we all share. And November 11th, going into the 12th, not this past November, the November before, in the middle of the night, there's a woman in a sapphire, deep, deep blue sapphire gown appeared at the foot of my bed, and she was so powerful, her magnetism woke me up out of my sleep. And I found myself more entranced by her robe than her long, dark hair and her face, which was almost kind of hidden, because it was almost like her robe was the fabric of the universe, and it was pulling me out of my body like a vacuum cleaner, and I grabbed onto the sheets and blankets, and my wife, Crystal's asleep next to me, doesn't know what's going on, and she's trying to take me somewhere, and she doesn't announce her name. She's very mysterious, and I just say, no, I'm not going, because I don't know who you are. And then she gives me the secret to the Mona Lisa, on how to decode the Mona Lisa, a secret that Da Vinci hid in it that was so powerful, the Inquisition definitely would have assassinated him under the different Inquisitions that were alive in his time. And he actually takes the painting unfinished from Italy, and he takes it to France, where King Francis I actually becomes his benefactor, and actually houses the painting. So there's a reason for that, and we'll actually see all that. But before we get into how did I decode the Mona Lisa, or how did the woman in the sapphire gown teach me, we have to see a little bit of a short little history lesson. You know, Da Vinci was born April 15th, 1452. And in 1453, the Muslim conquerors at Constantinople, where the first primary, you know, Christian church is established, in Turkey, what is now Turkey, in Constantinople, the Muslim conquerors take it by force and conquer it and destroy the Christian armies. And now the Catholic Church presides at Rome. And Rome is where, in this period of Da Vinci's life, the Roman Empire is actually already collapsed. the Roman Empire is no longer the Roman Empire. The Catholic Church is really the new empire. And when we go all the way back to the time of Christ and the period where all these gospels, all these teachings of Jesus are circulating throughout the world, and that Jesus' disciples had spread themselves. Thomas went to India, and Mark went to Egypt, and the disciples were going all over the planet, and Mary Magdalene and Joseph of Arimathea went into Europe to preach the Gospels. And when you read these secret Gospels of the disciples going all over the planet, you're discovering that they are enlightened beings. They're like mini masters. They're performing miracles that almost appear greater than some of the things Jesus did. And what starts to happen is that it's amazing that out of what we call the 12 disciples, there's actually even more than that, and there are seven women, mysterious women that we learn about in the secret Gospels. What's really amazing is the empires are collapsing because of Jesus. Because Jesus empowered the poor, and under the pagan laws in the Roman Empire, under pagan law, people were forced to believe, almost like the East Indian caste system, where it says that the Brahmins, if you're born Brahmin and rich, you're spiritually and physically superior to an untouchable. In the Roman Empire, Caesar was Apollo. He was said to be the embodiment of Apollo, and the senators in the Roman Senate were the embodiments or the incarnation of the gods and the goddesses. And this empire was oppressive. Over 90% of the empire was poor, and people were tired of it. They were tired of being, you know, we're spiritually inferior and we're financially inferior. And Jesus came along and said that everything was upside down, that you poor people would actually inherit the kingdom of heaven before the rich. And just by those words, historians believe Christians and Jesus destroyed the Roman Empire. By the 64 AD, the famous burning of Rome, when Nero, you know, what they call Nero, and the Emperor Nero, and the burning of Rome, actually found that the true kind of conspirators who were burning Rome were the Christians, were the new Christians. And the Christians were being tortured in the amphitheaters, and more miracles were occurring to people like Thecla of Iconium and Vivia Perpetua, these women who went in to be tortured, and the animals would lie down, and miracles would happen, and all of a sudden, everyone was becoming Christian. So what started to happen was, because Rome accepted it was falling, and that Da Vinci was born in the period when Rome had completely fallen. By 1000 AD, Rome had completely fallen. The new religion, Christianity, had usurped the old religions, the pagan religions, and they would be damned if they wouldn't be able to maintain their control in the visages, in the images and faces of their previous deities. So what they did is they created councils. The first council of Nicaea in, you know, 4th century AD, they were deciding on what were to be the true Christian gospels. And during these councils at Nicaea, which is actually in Constantinople in Turkey, which is before, you know, the fall of the church at Constantinople in 1453, a year after Da Vinci's birth, what's happening is the councils are all male councils, and they won't allow women to vote on what are to become the true Christian gospels. And what's amazing, personally, from having studied all these ancient gospels, is that you have 12 disciples, and you only have 4 accounts in the canonized 4 Gospels today, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But in addition to them, you have people like Simon and Simon Peter, you have Judas, you have James, you have Mark, Mark is one of the canonized ones, you have Thomas who went to India, you have Mary Magdalene, you have all these other Gospels that were thrown out. And what's consistent in these Gospels is discussions about the divine feminine, the Sophia of Christ, that Christ had a feminine counterpart to himself, and he had a feminine partner in his mysticism and in his philosophizing and teachings, who was Mary Magdalene. And those Gospels, I believe, were thrown out because they're so rich in literature on the divine feminine. For example, even the Gospel of Philip, you know, has a lot of this literature. So what you find is very clearly that all of these councils at Nicaea and at Hippo in North Africa, and finally at Trento in Italy just after Da Vinci's death, it was very consistent. Women were not allowed to vote on the councils. And yet, when God created man and woman in God's image, God was clearly male and female. In fact, even our last pope, Pope John Paul, who just passed away, and we now have the new pope, Cardinal Ratzinger, the last pope stated, Pope John Paul, that in his open letter to artists, that artists should start painting the image of God, or portraying the image of God as both masculine and feminine. Well, with all of that, why was it that women were not considered equal in the image of God to men? Why were they not allowed to vote when most of the Christian literature circulating around the empire gave this very clear picture of the divine feminine and the divine and the masculine as one and both being equal? Well, what starts to happen, of course, becomes very clear. The four Gospels, one, women were not allowed to vote, and women as priestesses were not allowed to even exist in the structure of this new church, this new Roman church. And when the church falls at Constantinople, there's absolutely no hope of a competitive view that the Catholic, which means one united view, would usurp and triumph over all other views and become almost the legal body for the representation of Christ's teachings. Now, when they say there was divine providence, which is what we're taught, that God presided over the councils and that we made the right decision, there were only four true gospels, even though there were dozens and dozens of other stories out there or gospels, that God was presiding over the council. Well, the antithesis to that is, well, if God was both masculine and feminine, why weren't women allowed to vote in the gospels? And why were women inferior to men? This becomes very important in Da Vinci's time, because during Da Vinci's time, there are gospels circulating in the empire that are, it's still not 100% solid. It doesn't become solidified until the final council at Trento, Italy, in 1545 and 1547. There were eight actual hearings. So, and Da Vinci, dies just before this, So he's born and his whole life is in the middle of it. And when I learned how to decode the Mona Lisa, and this is not abstract, this is very, very clear, there's no question that Da Vinci's life would have been in danger had he divulged his secret and his understanding of the Gnostic literature. There's no doubt he would have been burned at the stake, and he had to fear for his life. And he may have already feared for his life, and that may have been what motivated him to move out of Italy and come into King Francis I in France, and to be protected by him with the Mona Lisa. So there we are. I mean, here I am in the 21st century, and there's a woman in a sapphire robe appearing at the foot of my bed. Who is she? Why is she telling me who she is? And why is she telling me, David Sarita, how to decode the Mona Lisa when I'm not really in this business of Da Vinci codism? I think it was a very interesting, book and film, but again, there were a lot of serious mistakes. And I definitely am one who believes it is possible that Jesus, before I had my experience, I was one who believed it was possible that Jesus may have had a bloodline and may have been with Mary Magdalene. I had no reason to have a problem with that, considering most of the great religions of the world, there was always a feminine, counterpartner. Muhammad was married, Krishna was with Radha and Shiva and Uma, and Buddha had a wife, Yasodhara, and they had a son, and he attained enlightenment. I mean, you can go all the way down the list, and you'll always find these divine love couples. So there's no reason to believe that Jesus had to be, a man who didn't have family and didn't have a wife. I was already clear about that. But what happened, and the journey that this woman would take me on, was so profound for me, because it proved that the mystique of the Mona Lisa, the most famous painting in the history of the world, a painting that Jackie Onassis Kennedy actually brings to America in the 1960s in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, because she becomes so obsessed with it. This painting there's something about it. When people look at it, they see a man and they see a woman. They see Some people think Leonardo da Vinci himself. I mean, it has mystified civilizations since its creation. So what the woman in the blue gown tells me is that you have to look at the letters Mona Lisa, and you have to look at the Fibonacci mathematical sequences and put apostrophes between the letters, not rearranging the letters, just putting apostrophes in Fibonacci sequence. And that's the first step in decoding the painting. And so you look at, you know, Mona Lisa is 8 letters. 8 is a Fibonacci number. And Leonardo Fibonacci was the Leonardo in Italy before Da Vinci, who precedes Leonardo da Vinci and brings us off of the Roman numeral system in the kind of collapsing of the Roman Empire to the decimal system. And he gives us a mathematics that he learns from the far, you know, Middle East. And he tells us that in nature there are these sequences, and the sequences are mathematically pristine to everything in creation. When you see the spiral of a galaxy or a seashell or the spiraling of DNA, the ratios of those spirals in relation to each other come in Fibonacci sequences. And Fibonacci basically gives us a set of numbers that are in his sequence, and they are 0, 0, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, and so on. And all you have to do is add the previous number to the larger number to get the next number in the sequence. Hence, you add 1 plus 2 and you get 3, so 3 is the next number. 3 plus 2, 2 plus 3 and you get 5, and 5 plus 3 you get 8, and 8 and 5 you get 13. So when you divide 5 into 13, you get closer, the smaller number into the larger number, you get closer and closer to what is called a Fibonacci ratio of 1 to 1.618, meaning one number goes into the next number 1.618 times. And that is the golden mean ratio. Well, what the woman in the gown was telling me was all I have to do is break 8 down, 8 letters in Mona Lisa down to its next constituent Fibonacci numbers. And the next number down is 5 and the next one is 3. Right? So you have 3 letters plus 5 letters equals 8 letters. And then she shows me that the ancient Arabs and Hebrews, we know this, they read from right to left, and the French and the English read from left to right in most other European countries. So people who study Da Vinci knows that he did everything in this mirror-like philosophy. So what I did is I put apostrophes as my you know, priestess, high priestess in the saffron robe tells me, between the third and the fifth letters, from right to left and left to right. So when you go from left to right, you put an apostrophe at the M-O-N apostrophe Alisa. So you get Mon Alisa as your translation from left to right, which is French and English. And interestingly, in French and English, you cannot say Mono Alisa in French and Italian. You can't say Mono Alisa. You would say Mon Alisa. You would put an apostrophe at the N and drop the O between the two words. And mono means singular or one, and alisa means great joy in the feminine in ancient Hebrew. Great joy. So the singularity brings great joy in the feminine. Now, when you go from right to left the way the Arabs read and the ancient Hebrews, the apostrophe is at the L. So you get Mona Lisa, meaning you can't say L-E-Isa in French and Italian, just like you can't say the star, which is l'étoile in French. You say l'étoile, the star. You can't say the Isa, you say, which is l'E-Isa. It's Lisa. So it's Mona Lisa. And the apostrophe at the L, what is the Isa? Well, Isa in ancient Arabic is Jesus. In fact, if you look in the Quran, Jesus' name is Isa in the Quran. So a And also, for the ancient Hindus, Jesus was known as Isa. In the Bhavisha Mahapurana, which you can search on Google, this is a famous ancient Hindu manuscript, Jesus is appearing at the base of Mount Kailash in Tibet, which is the most sacred mountain to the Tibetans and the Hindus. It's said to be the abode of Lord Shiva for the Hindus. And at the base of this mountain is Jesus, who appears as this kind of, you know, white robe, a bearded man from Europe, who says, "I am Isa Masiha," meaning Jesus the Messiah. And we see also there was Nicholas Notovich was an author and discoverer in Tibet of an ancient manuscript that described Jesus as Saint Isa. Well, here's what's really interesting, is Mona the Isa translates to Mona the Jesus, and yet Mona is a woman. We can clearly see that she's a woman, but people intuit that she might be a man also. This is where it gets really amazing. And when I got this far in the literary translation using the Fibonacci decoding system with apostrophes, and Da Vinci said simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, apostrophes are the most simple things you could use to decode the letters. Isa, Mona the Isa, meaning Mona the Jesus, why would Mona be Jesus? I mean, what does that mean? Unless you know the secret that I had already studied in the Gnostic literature. And Isa, according to Joseph Flavius, he was the great Jewish Roman scholar who wrote Antiquities of the Jews. I always get tongue-tied in his name. Anyway, he wrote in Antiquities of the Jews that the name for a woman, referring to Eve in the book of Genesis, the name for a woman is Isa. So why would Jesus' name to the Arabs, the ancient Arabs and the ancient Hebrews and the Hindus, be Isa if it means woman? Why was Jesus' name that of woman when to scholars in Hebrew, Jesus was Yeshua? Well, there's a reason. And the reason is in the gospel, it's called the Acts of John, which was banned by Pope Leo the Great because in the midst of this gospel, during one of Jesus' transfigurations to his disciples in a blaze of light, Jesus shapeshifts physically into a woman right in front of his... And this is before the crucifixion. And it's so clear that John, who Jesus is appearing to in the disciples in this blaze of light, he comes up to Jesus and looks upon his hinder parts and says he was not a woman at all, which could only mean in the negative space that anatomically he had transfigured into a man. Now, in the Apocryphon of John, which is post-crucifixion, another illegal manuscript, Jesus does the same thing to the same disciple, John. He appears to John in a blaze of light like thousands of suns after the crucifixion, and as he's appearing to John, he shapeshifts in this blaze of light from the old man with a white beard, whom Jesus never lived to be old enough to be, as the Ancient of Days, into the young man whose beard was just beginning, and then into a woman. And he says, "John, John, why do you doubt, or why are you afraid? That is, do not be timid. I am the one who is with you always. I am the Father, I am the Mother, and I am the Son. I am the undefiled and incorruptible one." So there's two examples, you know, utterly conclusively, that Jesus was shape-shifting into the Mother of God, the feminine aspect of God, known as the Sophia. And so it was clear to me that because these Gospels were undecided during Da Vinci's time, and that Da Vinci studied in the Middle East, surely he would know that Jesus' name was Isa to the Arabs, that he would paint an image, a transfigurative image of a woman who is actually Jesus Christ in the Mona Lisa. So at this point in my investigation, I had to say I didn't have the conclusive proof. All I knew was that the letters decoded made sense from right to left and left to right, only using apostrophes. And you can take any sentence you want and try to do that and see if you get a decoding. You won't get anything. Like, my dog has fleas, and you put an apostrophe in the Fibonacci sequence, and you're not going to get anything. Why does it decode into something perfectly both ways? Well, in the middle of my research, and it wasn't the woman in the sapphire gown who did this, I researched on Google and found that the Canadian and French government x-rayed the Mona Lisa, and there was no press about what they found underneath the skin of paint on the front of the Mona Lisa. Underneath her, transfiguratively, is clearly the image of Jesus Christ. And it's so clear, my wife Crystal found when we were looking at it, that when you compared it to the surface of the Mona Lisa, that you could see Jesus with his beard, and you would see the curly rings coming out of his left and right side of his face, consistent with what the rabbis, the Jewish rabbis, were told by God in the Old Testament, thou shalt not mar or shave the corners of thy beard. That's why you see the ringlets of coming off the edge of the rabbis' beards when you see them at the Wailing Wall. And then you see the blood from the crown of thorns dripping over Jesus' eye in his beard. I mean, it's clearly Jesus underneath. And nobody said anything in the press because nobody knew what was Jesus doing under the image of Mona, the Mona Lisa. What was he doing there? This doesn't make any sense to anybody unless you understand the transfigurative of Christ, where Jesus shapeshifted from the masculine to the divine feminine. And this is what I believe was very clear in the letters and is very clear in the x-ray, that Da Vinci's message was in the Mona Lisa. And that is why, for centuries, people have debated whether it's a man or a woman. And the reason is because part of our brain receives the x-ray image, which is underneath the painting. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are other artists who have actually done the same thing. They would create a painting and then paint over it, because subliminally, there is a part of the brain that is so sophisticated that it is sensitive to even deep ultraviolet rays could penetrate through the surface of the painting. So part of the brain is getting the message, it's a woman and it's a man. It's transfigurative. But when we see that it's Jesus, it's conclusive that this is not abstract, that this is the transfigurative Jesus Christ that the ancient Gospels, the Apocrypha of John, and the Acts of John both spoke of. And later, when you read the Sophia of Christ, we learn when Jesus appears on the mountain above the Sea of Galilee after the crucifixion, that there are seven women disciples present, and there are the traditional male disciples all receiving the teaching about the beginning of the creation of the universe, where God was originally a monad, a singularity, hence Mona in Mona Lisa. The monad concept actually goes back to the time of Pythagoras. So it was a concept that was popular, you know, far before the arrival of Christ. So what Jesus does in this blaze of light when he appears to all of his students on the top of the mountain is he's showing them that God starts as a monad, a singularity, and divides into the masculine image of God and then into the divine feminine, which is known as Sophia. Now, Sophia means wisdom in Greek, but Sophia is the actual divine personality in addition to wisdom as the divine feminine Sophia. So when you come back to the Mona Lisa again, you see it, the translation from left to right with the apostrophe at the N, Mona Lisa, Mono Lisa. You see singularity, mono, brings great joy. So we go from the singularity of God, but then Da Vinci even more beautifully blends in the masculine image of God underneath and the feminine on the surface, the Sophia. So it's very, very clear. I mean, when you see my film, Mona Lisa's Little Secret, you get to see all this, which is really, really exciting. And it becomes crystal clear. But then we go much further in the film than just, okay, now we know Da Vinci did this and his life would definitely be in danger. But then you start to wonder, was Da Vinci part of a cult? What would be considered a cult of the divine feminine in Christianity during his life? And when we look at the total body of his work and his other paintings, you will see consistently he paints his women, including the Virgin Mary, in the blue sapphire gown. And why the blue sapphire gown? And why did the woman appear to me in the blue sapphire gown? And then we start to see. And then what I did next is we go back to the time of Moses, and we see when God instructs Moses' brother, Aaron, before he goes into the temple on Mount Hebron to pray, he's instructed to wear the blue sapphire gown and then the breastplate of gems, the 12 gems. So mm-hmm. why the blue sapphire gown, and why did the male priests all wear the blue sapphire gown, and why did Da Vinci paint his women in the blue sapphire gown? Because he was coding them as high priestesses in the most ancient traditions in Judeo-Christianity.
That brings up a lot of interesting points. First of all, you know, what comes to mind when you're telling me this is, you know, the favorite color of pretty much everybody is blue.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the stuff that I've been through spiritually, they have always talked about how, you know, well, you know, if you're working, you know, in the realm of Jesus the Christ, then your color is blue. And they're different colors of blue depending upon what people are doing. But I find this really fascinating, and I also find it fascinating because you're talking about Jesus announcing that he is the Father and the Mother, and that was all wiped out. And you were going to talk about that too, about the Gnostic Gospels and how all references to the feminine were wiped out. And it's just so fascinating to me, David, and seeing your film of Mona Lisa's Little Secret, it's like you just sit there with your mouth open going, wow, this is cool.
Well, I really feel like women got badly ripped off. And even when I look at Islam, I mean, Muhammad had a wife, and he was very respectful to women. And I feel in a lot of ways that even today, you know, even in Christianity, early Christianity, women kind of were beaten down in their respect and their role in civilization. And women's views in everything from physics, I mean, even Einstein stated publicly that it was his wife who was co-responsible for the theory of relativity, but when he tried to give her credit, all the men just laughed at him and said, oh, well, you know, you're just trying to be nice to her. And
yeah.
And that's kind of sad in our culture, because women have not been at par and equal to men in the political process arena, in the arena of spirituality, in the image of God and power. Obviously, inside the Vatican, women don't vote and they don't play a role. And I believe if they did, if they were equal, we wouldn't have all of this sexual child abuse that goes on, that's been going on in the Catholic Church either. Because you can't imagine if abuse like that was going on, if there were women in power, what they would do to the men. I mean, they would just castrate them right from day one. So it's really sad that this happened. But what's even more amazing is today, the brainwashing, I believe, of the masses is so profound that women today don't even think they're worth it. They believe there was divine providence presiding over those councils, and all the other gospels were evil. Well, why would the gospel of Thomas, who was a disciple of Jesus, and Philip, who were disciples of Jesus, be considered heresy? I mean, why, if there's 12 disciples, and we don't even count the 7 mystery women and the 3 Marys, why are their accounts not legitimate to the church? Why is only Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? And that alone is enough to be suspicious. But when you read Philip, it's so rich with the divine feminine. In fact, in the Mona Lisa's Little Secret, it's clear that Dan Brown missed reading the entire Gospel of Philip, because there is proof in there, which is in Mona Lisa's Little Secret, that Mary Magdalene and Jesus had children, and it shows how they had children. And it was really amazing, too, because in Da Vinci Code, there was all this emphasis that Jesus kissed Mary Magdalene on the lips. And there was all this emphasis about the kiss. And it's actually in the kiss, according to the Gospel of Philip in the preceding literature, that Jesus, firstly, was given all of the powers of the Father in heaven. And if we refer to, if we believe this, that in the beginning God breathed the soul into Adam and Eve, into the first human beings, like a wind, like a transferring of air. And we consider that those powers were given to Jesus. It is clear in the Gospel of Philip. I mean, get ready for this, because you're the first people in the world to hear this. I have not told this to, unless you've seen Mona Lisa's Little Secret, you will not know this. But when Jesus kisses Mary Magdalene on the lips, it's set up in the preceding literature that it was through the kiss that life was transferred in the womb. That Jesus didn't need to have sex to have children. He was so powerful that just by a kiss, he could impregnate Mary Magdalene. And that was why the kiss was so sacred in the literature. But all the press in the Da Vinci Code just focused on, well, if he kissed her, he must have had sex with her. But there's no evidence in any literature, in any Gnostic literature I've ever read, that Jesus had sex with Mary Magdalene or anybody. Not a shred. But there is evidence that he kissed her for the purpose of putting life in her womb through the power of the kiss. And having met Christ in person three times, I have no doubt that Jesus has the power to create galaxies. I mean galaxies.
Yeah.
So creating life in a womb is child's play for a being at this level. I mean, utterly child's play. So, to me, it doesn't matter whether he had sex or not. That's not the important thing. The important thing is how powerful these beings are that they can impregnate through a kiss. And it says in the Gospel of Philip that the perfect ones have the power to conceive and give life in the womb through a kiss. So it means that there are other perfect ones who have this power also,
mm-hmm.
and had it. And I believe what happened is because of the persecution of the Christians, and most of the disciples of Christ, other than John, were either crucified or murdered. Thomas was hacked to bits with swords in India, and Simon was crucified upside down. I mean, the Roman Empire and the Jewish Empire were trying to eradicate this religion with all of their might. So Mary Magdalene had to flee into Europe with Joseph of Arimathea, and it would be there that she would have given birth to their children and sequestered them in this secret.
Mm-hmm.
And that no one to this day would know, exactly where her body lies and where her children are. I mean, that is something that a lot of people like Lawrence Gardner and Philip Gardner have tried to unravel the mystery, and they've done a really good job. So that is where all this goes. There in the Gospel of Philip, Dan Brown missed it. It is the kiss where the power of the transference of life occurred, and that is how Jesus impregnated Mary Magdalene. And,
it makes sense, too, because if you think about the DNA, where do we take DNA evidence, for instance, at a crime scene? You take a swab of...
From saliva.
A swab from the cheek. You're looking for the cheek cells.
Right.
And
also from the saliva in the mouth. You
right.
can take it from the cheek. You can take it from... Yeah, and kissing her... on the lips, it clearly, I mean, DNA is exchanged, but the power to conceive life through a kiss is something that we can't conceive of in our time. I mean, I know a lot of people doubt miracles because they don't see very many people today, unless you go deep into Tibetan Buddhism or India, where miracles occur on a regular basis. And we're so far removed from miraculous consciousness in the West through our media, that people doubt, Jesus, was there a virgin birth, was there not. When I experienced Jesus in person, I saw the entire universe manifesting out of the body of Christ. And believe me, there's nothing that cannot be done. Manifesting a child in the womb, this is literally child's play for beings that know how to create galaxies and stars and planets and universes. So
it's
really very simple. But what's exciting is, Da Vinci, it's really amazing that I almost think, how did he know that we would eventually invent the X-ray and we would find out what's underneath the Mona Lisa? Why wasn't the discovery that Jesus was under the Mona Lisa on every newspaper in the world? And
yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, and my discovery, in this film, it's not, and I also wrote the book, my wife and I wrote the book, which is at lulu.com/David Sarita, you can read the book Mona Lisa's Little Secret, which is massively detailed. And you can see how clear the story is. But why aren't stories like this, as big as the Da Vinci Code? Well, I don't know. I don't know how these things work,
Well, I think that, when you're talking about the truth, David, there are only so many people that are really ready to accept the truth. And so a lot of stuff, when it comes out as truth, the first thing that it gets is ridiculed,
Sure.
or worse, or if they come after the person that's revealing the truth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that a lot of when stuff is not out there in the mainstream, it's to protect you. You know, we do have guardian angels. We do have other guides that are around us. And you know, our time schedule is not God's time schedule. And so we get very impatient and we think, why isn't this happening? But, you know, everything has its own season, as they say. And I think really that sometimes these things happen because there's a protective aspect in it. It's not quite ready for everybody to see yet. But I think that by having your movie out and showing these things, you're going to get a groundswell of people that are going to see the truth and go, yeah, I always knew that there was something going on there. And now this makes perfectly good sense. And they'll
see
it
in the film Mona Lisa's Little Secret, when we interviewed just ordinary people, what is the painting to you? Most people intuit that it's both masculine and feminine. And I think almost everybody intuits that about it. And that's because the information of the masculine image of Christ is hitting their brain. They just don't see it visually. Mm-hmm. But what this really means to me is, how empowering is this for women if they really get it? I mean, I showed the film Mona Lisa's Little Secret to like 35 women in my house on, you know, with a digital light projector on the wall. Mm-hmm. And when you see women's response to it, it's so empowering for women to get this, that you are equal to men in every way and that you are high priestesses, absolutely. And that the history books wrote women out of the image of God and being equal to men in the power, in the structure, and in the church. That now this is your birthright. Here's the proof. I'm giving you the proof in the Mona Lisa, but not just the Mona Lisa, in what were known as the Lost Gospels. And all you have to do is believe it. That it's your right to be equal to men in the church. And one day, who knows, the Vatican may let down the walls and you may see a woman as Pope, just as we're seeing a woman run for President of the United States.
Mm-hmm. I think it's coming, David.
Yeah, it's coming. And actually, your show, Valerie, this is the first time on any radio show I've told the story of the Mona Lisa's Little Secret, you know, in its entirety. I've mentioned it as a blip on Coast to Coast AM, but I've never done a full show anywhere. So
well,
this is a magical moment, you know, on radio. So I hope you get lots of listeners and they share this interview, and that people see Mona Lisa's Little Secret they can get it at voiceentertainment.net on the internet, the DVD. That's the only place you can get it right now, and Atlantis Rising magazine sells it as well.
And thank you for mentioning that, because my next thing was going to be, why don't you give out your website, David?
it's intuition. I knew it was coming.
yeah, exactly. Well, you know, as I said, I think this is really important. And, you know, bless you for, first of all, for listening and for really paying attention to what the guide that came to you was telling you. And, you know, showing you all of the truth. And thank you for being brave enough to go ahead and put that out there. Because, you know, a lot of people have problems with the truth because it messes up their life. All of a sudden it means that everything that they believed in is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people are unable to move past that yet. And so I think it's real important the way that you're doing this. And thank you for revealing all this on my show, because my listeners are really interesting people. You know, they're well read. They keep an ear to the ground on what's going around or going on in the universe, not just the world. But they're very very rational people, and so they can take this information now and they can spread it very subtly and in ways that most people are not even going to realize would hit them, because these listeners are pretty savvy. You know, and they're going to just kind of like let a little drop out here and there until finally there'll be this groundswell and people will be going, oh, yeah, well, you know, of course, this is all proven in this film. And, yeah, that guy David Sirita came up with all this. and it's
well, you know, one
really
thing
cool.
I was left sour with in the Da Vinci Code is that because Jesus was with a woman and there was a strong enough case for that, meaning Mary Magdalene, the authors use that as evidence. Well, he was an ordinary man who was with a woman who had sexual relations, therefore he was no longer this super divine personality. And there is nothing, I say to Dan Brown, that is in the Gnostic literature that because Jesus was with Mary Magdalene diminishes his status as a supreme being. And for me, meeting him in person, I can testify, I've met the Dalai Lama and all the Buddhists and the Hindus and wonderful meditation masters, but I have never seen any being so unbelievably, blindingly full of love and ecstasy and power who carries the wisdom and the power and the grace of the whole universe. And there is no way, when you read the Gnostic literature, that there is any evidence that Jesus was nothing less than exactly who Jesus said he was. So using this idea that he was a family man and had sex and children as evidence for diminishing him, that left a sour note in my mouth in Da Vinci Code. And what I show in Mona Lisa's Little Secret, and thanks to my wife Crystal also for some amazing research and contributing to the project, that it is clearly the opposite, that the divine masculine and feminine are both the true image of God, and that none of that divinity is stripped away. We don't strip away Krishna and Radha because he had a wife, their divinity. We don't strip away Buddha's divinity because he had a child named Rahula and a wife named Yasodhara, who also attained nirvana. We don't strip away, you know, Shiva because he was with a consort named Uma. But somehow, the world was educated that Jesus had to be alone, and he couldn't possibly have loved a woman. And when you look at these other stories that I've just mentioned of all these other great religions, and that even Muhammad had a wife and took more wives after his first wife passed, there's just no question that it's possible and that it doesn't strip them of their divinity.
Well, and why should it? You know, when you think about the one we call Jesus, he is the master of love in all of creation. And it would seem completely illogical to me that he would not have had a wife and children when he's the master of love itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just doesn't make any sense to me. Of course, I've always been a little weird, you know, but I look at that, and having seen that being myself, I totally agree with you. I mean, that when you see the magnificent image of Jesus, and that's only the toned down image, that's not the complete one, we would just go poof if we were in the presence of the one we call Jesus if that energy wasn't stepped down, because we couldn't handle it.
Well, we couldn't handle it. And that's
but I mean, just at that, at the level that we're considered to be able to handle it, I mean, I was on my knees. And just the purity of that being, the love, the absolute unconditional love, loving us as we are with all of our faults and all of our foibles, and loving the entire creation. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind whatsoever that that being is exactly what he said he was, and that he is love. No
doubt. So again, why would Dan Brown do that? Like, why go so far with, you know, the great revelation that he started and then try to, like, slam Jesus down? You know, I just don't understand it. I was so heartbroken at the end of the movie and the book. It just felt like, God, why is it so popular to bash Jesus and try to, you know, slander him of his status? And, I mean, and what's even more amazing about things like that are, in the Da Vinci Code, the way they went with it, is you're talking to the largest religion in the history of the world, you know, 2.2 billion Christians. So even though you made a lot of money on the film, you didn't convince the world that Jesus was not the Son of God. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's a problem with that kind of portrayal, but I think that a lot of it has to do with, you know, not everybody is openly intuitive like you are.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody gets a visitation from an ascended being or an angel and remembers it. You know, most people don't remember it because they can't believe that they would actually have a visit like that. When in truth, we each have two archangels and a legion of angels around us all the time. And so
I mean, a lot of people are getting visits with Christ. I mean, it's happening to a lot of people. I mean, I know scores of stories just in my personal life of individuals I've met or spoken to who have met Christ. And, you know, to me, these stories, every single one of them, every single person who has had an apparition of Christ in modern days should be able to tell their story in some kind of global forum. And because each one of us gets a piece of the greater picture of, you know, what the message is, you know, from the light, from the God, you know, the monad, the singularity. I mean, what Jesus says in the Sophia of Christ, which you can search on Google, is that in the beginning, the monad always existed and never did not exist. It was the masculine and feminine aspect of God that comes into existence and then takes form, ultimately, and takes birth in the flesh. And so, you know, for people who don't or have a hard time, like even an agnostic who believes in a higher force can relate to the monad, which is the Mona in Mona Lisa, the singularity, the field of consciousness that exists throughout the universe. And I think Da Vinci was trying to say it all in one painting, even how carefully he selected the letters, the 8 letters in Mona Lisa and the Fibonacci sequencing and the apostrophes as decoders, and then ultimately, you know, the X-ray showing what's underneath it. He thought deeply about it, and in fact it took him years and years to finish the painting, you know, and take it away from Italy in fear of the Inquisition's wrath. And I even project it's possible that Da Vinci belonged to a divine feminine cult and the members were murdered by the Inquisition and he had to run for his life and seek shelter with Francis, you know, one in France, and say, here, you know, take the painting, take care of it for generations. And because he was king, you know, he would be the perfect person to do that. And now it resides in the Louvre Museum in France, where it's very well protected. But anyway, I hope that women especially heal from their diminished status as equal to men in the image of God, and that the words of Pope John Paul in his open letter to artists before he died, that we should start painting the image of God as both masculine and feminine. And I even wonder, you know, am I one step behind the Pope? Did he know? He saw what was under the Mona Lisa. Of course he saw the X-ray, because it was done years and years ago. And he must have known. He must have known.
Yeah, but he couldn't let that out, because he, think about how fanatic a lot of people that are in the dogma of a religion are. I mean, they kill people, David. And,
oh,
you know, they don't want to know the truth. It's like, don't bother me with the truth, you know. Let me just go along with this little dream that I have here.
Yeah.
And so even if he knew, there's no way that he could come out with it.
Yeah, there's,
you know,
no
that,
way. If he knew, he and even if he believed it. And I think that's kind of a position the church has got itself in that's too bad. I mean, the Catholic Church cooperatively studies and exchanges meditation techniques with the Buddhists, with the Tibetans, and thanks to people like Thomas Merton. And a lot of Catholics don't know that. I mean, I'm Catholic myself, Catholic mystic myself. I was baptized Catholic, and I love Catholic mysticism. I love the Virgin Mary as co-redemptrix of sins for Christians, even though a lot of Protestants and fundamentalists don't believe that. You know, that's fine. That's their belief. I respect that. But what's exciting here is that it is the Vatican, probably the library of knowledge they have and the secret manuscripts they have in their possession is so powerful. It has literally shaped. The Protestants are victims of whatever knowledge the Catholics allowed out. The Protestants don't have access to the secret manuscripts. They never did. It was after the church was destroyed at Constantinople in 1453, it was one Catholic United Church. And by the time the Gospels reached Europe and the Americas, there were only 4. And so all the other Christian religions were victims to those decisions that led to the 4. And now, when you say, oh, have you read the Gospel of Mary Magdalene? Have you read the Sophia of Christ? Have you read the Gospel of Philip or Thomas? A fundamentalist will say, oh, that's all heresy and evil. Well, how do you know that? Why do scholars like Elaine Pagels at Princeton University not believe that? Because she is one of the translators of these pieces of work. Why do major university scholars all over America study and believe in the Gnostic Gospels. Because the more you study your history, as I presented this evening, it is very clear what was happening to the true Gospels of Christ. They were being burned and destroyed by the conquerors.
Well, yeah, and we could go on for another couple of hours on this stuff, but I mean, there are things that happen, that things that were put into the Bible, you know, and how many times it was rewritten, just so that the masses could be controlled, and they wouldn't realize that what Jesus taught about was total freedom. And not allowing somebody else to take control over you. And, you know, it was not, you know, oh, yes, you should obey the king. It was like, no, you only live in love, and you only deal with people that are in truth, and it's perfectly okay to, you know, smack somebody upside the head if they don't deal in truth and in love, which I always thought was really interesting, because that's something that never comes out, and it was in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yep, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and things like the Gospel of Thomas, where Thomas refers to the singularity, which is the monad, meaning mono, meaning one, mm-hmm. of God, I mean, dozens of times. And that singularity of God, you could commune with yourself. It was nameless. It was pure. It was virgin light that always existed. And the Gospel of Thomas, Elaine Pagels testifies at Princeton University, is all about the individual attaining enlightenment and not even necessarily needing the church. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the church is there to provide you shelter and a place to pray and access to the real records and teachings of Jesus, that is a very good church, and it does serve a good purpose. But when the truth is distorted and destroyed, and they know it, and it's hidden in the annals of the Vatican, that is a disservice to Christ, in my opinion.
Oh, I totally agree. It's a disservice to humanity. And I would go so far as to say,
because humanity doesn't get to see that the real image of God is masculine and feminine, and that, and not only that, but that you can actually attain this on your own, this communion with this singularity of God, without a force or a power that could dictate your life and could decide for you whether you got into heaven or hell. You could do this yourself. That's what Thomas was saying. And that's what the Gnostic teachings were all about. Gnostic means gnosis, which is knowledge in Greek. And wisdom is Sophia, feminine. In fact, a Tibetan nun actually told me this, that the women in Tibetan Buddhism were the wisdom keepers, not the men. Hence, Sophia means wisdom. And feminine aspect of God and mystic Christianity.
Well, and if you look at the history that we have had as humanity, you know, look at all the witch hunts and everything else, and all it was about was getting rid of all the wise women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take them out of the picture, and suddenly the people can't be healed, and, you know, they're in fear for their immortal souls because of the propaganda that they heard, and you know, all that kind of crap. And, you know, that has to be changed now. Now is the time for the truth to come out. And people need to know that they can reach that divine oneness within themselves. Mm-hmm. And, I think I've told you, when I took that quantum vortex around, I had atheists that had God experiences. And it shocked the hell out of them. They were going, I didn't know that God existed. And it wasn't something I told them to do. This was something they came upon themselves because they were in the zero-point field where there's no obstruction to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And they found it within themselves, and I thought that was so fascinating.
You know, when you read the lives of the saints, like St. Teresa of Avila, the Catholic saint, and St. Bernadette of Cibaru, which is where the holy spring water is, it's interesting that as women who were having this experience of Christ consciousness and actually had apparitions of the Virgin Mary or Christ, they were told that they were seeing visions of Satan. But a Saint Francis of Assisi, a masculine image who says he's seeing images of, he's being visited by Christ, doesn't get as scorned by his peers as the young women did in growing up. And I think a lot of that is still remnants of the masculine image of God, and that men could be the only proper channels of the divine. And it was part of the beating of the women, but eventually those women triumphed, and they convinced their peers that they were truly receiving visions of God. And it's amazing how they were treated, you know, in the monasteries, and scorned and ridiculed, and the struggle that they had to go through to be accepted.
Yeah, it's shocking, and it's sad. You know, we've taken so long to get to where we are with humanity as a species, and, you know, our window of opportunity to go on into the next dimension now and to really live in paradise is all hinging upon the ability of people to see the truth and to embody it and to be love. And, you know, it's horrible. You know, I mean, it's kind of funny, but at the same time, it's horrendous that things have been changed. Yeah. I mean, there was
a period, I don't know how much time we have left, but there was a period when I saw recently a documentary about the child sexual abuse in the Vatican and in the Church, and the absolute denial of the Pope and the Cardinals. And Roger Mahoney, the Cardinal of Los Angeles, to do anything for the families of the victims of these children. That there was a moment when I doubted whether I wanted to be a Catholic anymore, whether I wanted to be even a Catholic mystic anymore. I was so angry, and I said, you know, why doesn't the Pope apologize? Why is he so arrogant? I was almost in tears after I saw this film. And within a week, he had apologized publicly to the children and the victims and the families. But why did it take so long? Why? I really believe, and I'm dwelling on this, but if women were in the church from the beginning, none of this would have happened.
True.
In the Greek church, Catholic church, the priests are allowed to marry, and they don't have this problem. And I really, I feel so much for what has happened. There, you know, we can laugh at it in one sense and just ridicule it, but in the other sense, it's really sad how many people have been turned off by even the name Jesus Christ because of, and I remember this in this film, one of the victims who was a devout Catholic, he couldn't even say Jesus' name anymore because the Pope never apologized to him for what happened to his children. And I felt that strongly that I was like, Jesus, you know, someone better apologize. Jesus, you need to come down and apologize. This whole church is carrying your name and they're abusing these children. And we need to apologize. We need not just apologize, we need to rectify the situation. And I believe there's no, you know, these are my last words, there's no better resolution than to let women be cardinals and pope in the Catholic Church to balance the masculine and feminine energy out and to act as mothers and overseers to the children in the church so that there no harm is ever done to these children who believe in Jesus.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and if women were in the church in those high positions, you know that that kind of stuff wouldn't have happened because they would have gone after those guys. You know, they would not have done the turn the other cheek on that. Women are very protective.
When you see this documentary, I'm trying to remember the name of the film. It was something like In God's Name or something like that. I would really encourage people to see this film. I just couldn't help but feel that. I mean, it's really up to women. It's up to women to see the Mona Lisa's Little Secret and believe it and take it into your soul that you have the right to be cardinal or pope one day. It's your right, and to not believe that there was providence presiding over councils that were all male, that women were not allowed to vote on. Where in the history books did it ever say, even in Genesis, that women were not equal to men in the image of God? Where does it say this? And where did Jesus, in any gospel, ever say that women should be, you know, diminished as nothing? It doesn't say this anywhere. So it's up to the women of the world to get educated and to see films like this, Mona Lisa's Little Secret, and to take that power inside of you and use it to triumph over this male dominant image of God and make it a balanced and equal world.
Well, yeah, and it, you know, when you really get into being on the other side and seeing how everything is, you realize that for whatever reason, for our lessons or whatever, we got split apart, and that's what created man and woman. But the truth of the matter is, there isn't any difference when you're on
There's
the other
no
side.
Difference.
Once you're met up with your other half, you two become one, and you know you're an androgynous being basically, which
you
is
become your own monad, your own singularity.
Exactly.
When I was in the presence of Christ three times, there was absolutely no perception of a man or a woman. It was just God consciousness. It was beyond both. And, you know, even though, you know, I can refer to Jesus as he, there is no, whereas when you're in the presence of man, you're in the presence of a man. Mm-hmm. You know, the physical imagery, I believe most of the time Jesus probably appeared masculine. I mean, I think he revealed the transfiguration as a feminine image only a few times, and rarely. But he did, to make the point.
Well, yeah, and I think that there's kind of a New Age custom that has been around here for quite some time where, you know, when you pray, you don't just announce to God, you say, Father, Mother, God, Goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And some people really object to that. And, you know, I've got a lot of religions under my belt. I laugh about how I collect religions because I'm looking for the truth in whatever religion that there is there because they all have a kernel of the truth somewhere. And so so when I pray to both, Father, Mother, because I realize...
Oh, yeah, I do that too. Every day when I meditate, I do, Our Father, Mother, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And
yeah.
I continue on. I mean, that's my prayer. It's changed in me. It's transformed. You know, I don't fear that I'm saying it wrong and therefore I'll go to hell. I mean, I'm past that. But I think the knowledge and brainwashing is so powerful in the church that there are people who would be afraid to say Our Father, Mother. Literally.
Oh, yeah.
They would fear for their life that they are saying the prayer wrong and that they're going to go to hell for saying it. And that takes a lot of courage. I mean, it does. I mean, it takes a lot of courage for women who are trying to be priests in Catholic churches in America, and they are successfully doing it, some of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can tell you things that I observed with traveling around. And I had invited some people with me to a service on Easter one day, and the woman had her robes on like she was a priest. And it was basically the ageless wisdom. And this one guy that was a born-again Christian, unfortunately, I had the bad sense to invite this guy, he sat behind me, and he started giggling. And he started guffawing, and he was so rude. He laughed, he practically screeched with laughter that this woman had the audacity to wear priest robes.
Mm-hmm.
And we got outside and I said, you know, if you had done that in one of the third world countries, especially during a voodoo nai-nai ceremony or something, I said, they would have just taken you out and killed you.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was really rude. And at the same time, I mean, this woman had brought in such an incredible spirit. The room was filled with the energy, the higher energy, which of course makes you laugh anyway. So I was like, okay, that was really rude. But on the other hand, I know this guy could not contain himself because that energy, when it enters into a room, will just collapse people. You know, they can just fall over in a faint. They can laugh hysterically. They have no control over what's going on because what it's doing is it's driving out the darkness within them, and it's bringing the truth. So it's kind of an interesting thing to watch. And, you know, I sometimes wish that I could get into that, but I usually don't break into giggles. You know, I'm just like, oh, yeah, wow, God energy. You know, I totally love it. So this is just so amazing what you've made in this movie, David, and thank you for making that movie.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about it. I mean, there's not very many radio shows that will let me talk about this. And you're the first to take it full on, you know, in the world. So
wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
I would like to see you continue with this and, you know, maybe do something about the Pistis Sophia and really get into it more because I think it's really necessary right now. It's necessary not only for the women who need to step up to the plate and need to make sure that the goodness and right in the way of, I mean, real right, real good, is what happens on the earth, because men will listen to women. And, you know, they may not want to admit to that, but the reality is, you know, if mama ain't happy, nobody gonna be happy.
That's true.
You know,
I mean, my goal with this is I would like to see it made into a feature film, and as it was in Da Vinci's time, running for his life and being involved in the Divine Feminine cult, and probably the members of the cult get killed, and that's when he takes the painting to France and seeks refuge with Francis I. And I think it would be a powerful film, and that way more people could get exposed to it. And, you know, we'll see, you know, where this goes. I mean, it could take years just for this little DVD to really get out there. And the book, which is, you know, and I couldn't find a major publisher for it, which I think I know why. But, you know, the book is lulu.com/David, S-E-R-E-D-A. And the movie is voiceentertainment.net. Just go to the, you know, you can see our three DVDs there. The Voice, Mona Lisa, and Water.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I so appreciate your being on, and I know the listeners will take this all to heart, and this is on the archives, too, so it's going to be out there. And, boy, listeners, I really hope that you do go and get a copy of David's film or read the book, because it was really interesting. I sat there going, wow, this is so cool. And I can tell you that I very much concur with what you said about the feeling, the energy of Jesus coming through that painting. There are quite a few of us that, I'm an artist too, and I have painted things underneath other things specifically for that purpose, never really realizing why I did it until later.
Mm-hmm.
Now I do it on purpose. But the whole point is to help people to open up and to become truth that they're searching for, and to realize that, you know, you have to go within, not outside of yourself. So I think the movie that you've made really, really brings that point across, and bless you for doing that, because that's I think that's going to open up a whole lot of eyes.
Yep.
Very interesting. Well, we'll have to have some discussion about the other books and movies that you've done, too. So, of course, you're going to have to come back, you know.
Yeah, I will, for sure.
Absolutely. And the listeners that are on the Fast Chat have just been really fascinated by this, so that is great.
Great.
And thank you again for being on. I appreciate it so much. And listeners, we have been talking with David Sirita. The movie is Mona Lisa's Little Secret. And there's also a book by that name, too. And please do and go check that out on, what's the website again?
It's voiceentertainment.net.net. And the book is lulu.com/David, S-E-R-E-D-A. And you can see Mona Lisa's Little Secret there.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, have a good night.
You too.
Thank you again.
You bet. Thanks.
Take care.
You too. Okay, listeners, I know that you love that. I love that too. And gosh, I feel so blessed that I get to bring this stuff to you guys. This is really, it's my dream too. You know, we're all in this dream together. We're all helping each other to wake up. And each one of us has a part in this dream. And we need to do our parts. And, you know, people like David Sirita are doing this amazing work to help us to wake up more. And so I'm very grateful for that, for his work, and for the fact that it is so amazingly wonderful and really taps into those parts of us that are searching for the truth. And I want to thank also Marjorie of Hydramay Skin Nutrition. And, you know, thanks so much, Marjorie, for making this possible, that I could bring this information to people. And the show has been brought to you by Hydramay. Until next week, you guys, you know I love you. Please take care of yourselves. Be happy, be healthy, and be who you really are. Nighty-night. Do 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 do
from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep. Come, my children, time to awake from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to
do 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 do